Hey friends, and welcome back to the Raising Young Achievers podcast. I'm your host, Sharia Woods, and today I'm excited to be joined by Nate Hilger. He is an economist and the author of the book, The Parent Trap. This is a very special episode for me because when I found Nate's book, I felt so validated. And if you've listened to my other episodes, you know I talk a lot about how hard it is to figure out how to give your kids what they need to be successful. And what Nate does is break down why it's so hard. He explains there are two buckets of responsibilities as parents. The first bucket is nurturing. That's the part that comes naturally to most of us, is caring deeply about your kids and providing the love and support that they need to thrive. But there's this other bucket, and it's called skill building. And doing those things successfully often requires a certain level of knowledge and skills of your own. And what we really need as parents is a team of specialists, right? We need tutors, doctors, psychologists, advocates, nutritionists, fitness experts. I personally could use a hairstylist. I don't think that particular one made it onto Nate's list, but there are so many things that we have to become good at as parents that, you know, just may not come naturally to us. And that doesn't mean that we're bad parents or we're not good parents. So if you've ever been in a situation where you felt like you were missing the mark as a parent, this episode is for you because Nate breaks down why no one can be a specialist at all these things. It's time for us to release that responsibility. In fact, Nate believes many of these things should be taken on by the government instead of individual parents having to become masters at all these different skills. But in lieu of reform, I think it's important for us to start thinking about how we can cultivate the right team of supporters for our kids so we don't have to feel like it's all on us. I think that's probably what it means when they say it takes a village, right? All right, let's jump in. Well, hi, Nate. Welcome to the show. It's so good to finally get to talk to you.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Yeah, thanks for having me. I know it's been a little while since we first chatted.
Yeah, I was just kind of getting started with the Raising Young Achievers work, and I had actually been looking to try to figure out how much parents were spending at home on their kids compared to what was happening at school, because I was shocked at how much money I was needing to spend just to try to keep my kid up with the curriculum. And I was at the library, and normally we just go and my son picks out books and we leave. But I saw your book and I was like, what is this? And it's the library, so it's free, right? So he was like, okay, I'll take it home and I'll see. And I opened it up and there was the answer to my question that I had been searching for. I had even reached out to a researcher friend of mine and was like, hey, do you have any studies on this? And we cannot find anything. And so grateful. And I guess on that note, if you could tell us a little bit, like, how did you come to write this book? Like, what made you start looking into the challenges that parents are facing and the barriers that are up to be able to help your child succeed?
There were a bunch of factors that led me to focus on this area I've called intergenerational mobility in economics, which is basically, why do poor parents have kids who are more likely to wind up poor, and rich parents have kids who are more likely to wind up rich? Why does that happen, and how can we kind of narrow those gaps? I think I got interested partly because I went to a big public school, and for my whole life, I went to big public schools in a really diverse, wonderful place, Orange County, California. And I was lucky to become close friends with people from many walks of life. And one of the things I really miss about being in school and being a kid is when you become friends with somebody, you meet their parents, you meet their siblings, you meet their dogs and cats, and you go to their house and you have dinner with them and you see really intimate things like how they're punished when they misbehave. And you see what is expected of them in terms of chores, and you see how they eat and what kinds of extracurricular things they do, how they talk about school at home, what the expectations are. You just get such a rich, intimate picture of childhood when you're a kid and you're embedded. And the differences were just mind-boggling to me between some of my friends. You know, I have some friends, their parents were surgeons or PhD scientists, and they lived in huge, peaceful, quiet houses with parents, you know, constantly keeping tabs on their school progress and their extracurricular progress and signing them up for things and, you know, just making sure they were like learning tons of skills constantly and mastering those skills and having any problems addressed quickly and thoroughly and professionally. And other friends whose parents obviously loved them just as much, were just as charismatic and funny, and, you know, felt just as strongly about the value of family. And they were much less involved in their kids' schooling and had very different expectations and kind of left things more up to their kids to figure out. And it wasn't always like better and worse, but it did seem starkly different to me. And the outcomes at the end of high school were very different in terms of what colleges people went to and whether they went to college and how their early careers took shape. And so that just got me really interested in it, from a personal perspective. And then I kind of landed in economics at a time when the advent of big data and long-term multi-generational data sets was kind of taking off. And it was like a revolution in the field. And so for the first time, you could study some of these issues in ways that had been previously impossible. And I found that whole development really fascinating and got to participate in it during my time in graduate school.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And as you're describing the two sets of parents, it's kind of, you hear the helicopter parent, and that's kind of said in a negative way. And I mean, maybe you don't want to go too over the top, but I think the idea that as a parent, you realize when you're in the system, you do need to be really engaged on the campus and push for your kids. Because even like as my son started kindergarten, I would, you know, step back, like, I don't want to be that parent. I don't want to push too much. I don't want to cause problems.
Yeah.
But then you see not going the way that you want it to go, and you realize like, hey, I do need to step up.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that got me into this work of looking at like, how do parents need to engage? Because I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know if what I was doing was right. And I have like the degrees and like I study policy. And so there's like an advocacy component of that. And I work in education in my day job. And so I feel like I have a lot of skills that made me able to do it that most parents don't. And that's kind of what your work is talking about. Like, you know, there may be some parents that are able to do all that, but the majority can't. And what do we do for those parents? But then I kind of look at another piece of it too, of like, you were talking about intergenerational mobility, like reverse economic mobility, because there's a lot of parents that they're new to the middle class. They haven't been on all these people's houses to see how they run. And like, oh, they're doing tutoring and they're doing coaching and they're doing all these different things. So they think, oh, I'm putting my kid into this great school. You know, I'm in a good neighborhood. Everything is fine. And then by the time you figure out, oh, this is actually not going well, it could be too late. You introduced this concept in the book about the difference between nurturing and skill building. And you alluded to that into your intro, like a parent has these two jobs and a parent can be good at one and not the other, or even, you know, they can be good at skill building and not good at nurturing too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So tell us a little more about that.
This distinction between caring or nurturing and skill building kind of came out of a desire to talk about the inequality of opportunity that is embedded in families and households in a way that wouldn't be so threatening to parents, because my reading of the research is that lower income and less educated families, on average, through no fault of their own, they tend to provide weaker opportunities for their kids in the, you know, we put a huge burden on the family to provide kids with opportunity. And it is really hard for lower income and lower education families on average to do that compared to higher income and higher education families. But that statement is really sensitive. It's really provocative and threatening, and it can be misinterpreted for good reason as statements about inferiority and superiority. And part of my mission in the book was finding a way to talk about that phenomenon in a way that was constructive and that didn't just shut down the conversation and make people feel like they were being accused of something or their value or worth as parents was being questioned. And so this distinction is about how most parents, a lot of parents, lower education, lower income, higher income, parents in all these groups are really able to excel at the caring and nurturing part of parenting. They are there for their kids. They make food that brings joy for their kids. They take their kids to sports games. They take their kids to uncles and aunts and grandma and grandpa's house to play with their cousins. They help their kid when they're sick. You know, they reassure their child that they have value and unique worth in the world. And they share their religion with their kid. You know, they take them to church. They pray with them. They teach them how to stand up straight and, you know, take pride in their where they come from and who they are. A lot of this stuff is something that is very accessible to all parents. And it's a big part of what parents take pride in and enjoy in parenting. So I tried to separate that stuff from another category a parental activity called skill building. Skill building is helping your kid when they're falling behind in reading, helping your kid with math, algebra 2, trigonometry, statistics, helping your kid when they are struggling with severe anxiety or depression, helping your kid when they have asthma and there's 8 complicated medical recommendations on how to handle the asthma, helping your kid when they're playing soccer or basketball and they have a conflict with another player on the team and they feel unable to realize their potential in the activity because they don't know how to handle the interpersonal dynamics. There's a lot of social, cognitive, behavioral skill development that is really complicated. And I don't think all parents are equally equipped to impart these skills to kids. And the point of this distinction is to hopefully take some of the pressure out of this conversation and say, you know what? Most of us do not know how to do a lot of stuff. You know, if I want to fly to Oklahoma or Utah, I don't buy an airplane and learn how to fly it. I just buy a ticket and ask a professional pilot to take me there. If I want to buy a house, I don't learn how to build a house. I just buy a house that was built by professional architects and construction workers. And I think the skill development side of parenting, I'm really pushing everybody to think about a little bit more like that, with more respect and professionalism. And that way, parents don't expect themselves and society doesn't expect parents to be able to provide all of those opportunities because they're just too complicated and expensive and time consuming for individual parents to do on their own.
Yeah. And I mean, that's really good because as a parent, like I've experienced this where you feel like you should be able to handle all of the things. And so you parsing that out into 2 categories was really helpful. And I think another element of it that you kind of talk about is for the wealthy parents, they're spending a ton of money. Like they can throw money at the problems like, okay, my kid is having this problem, I can do this. But when you don't have those economic opportunities, it can be really hard to find the resources.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I talk about with parents sometimes is the importance of advocating and like looking. And I think just knowing and being aware that there are things that I'm not going to be able to help with and there are people that I can reach out to can help. Like I'll give an example with my son. He's been struggling with some test anxiety because we have our state test coming up. And I called the counselor, not thinking it was going to be very helpful, but it was actually really helpful. And she was like, we have this free counseling service you can use. And we can do this like little mini group with a lot of kids that are having this problem. And she seemed really excited to hear from me. And so I was like, oh,
that's awesome. You know?
So thinking about like, okay, we can't do all the things, but how can we leverage what we have, knowing that we need a village? Like, and even just talking to peers, talking to other parents who are on the journey and like letting down that veil a little bit and saying like, hey, I'm struggling because I think a lot of times we want to put on the good face of like, yeah, I'm a great parent. I have it all under control. My kids are perfect. We're all perfect. And that's just not realistic.
Yeah. And I love what you're saying. I think just resetting expectations and norms around reaching out for professional help, finding even subsidized professional help, like let's talk to the school. Can the teacher or the principal help connect me with a coach, a counselor, a group, a club, you know, who can help me address this problem because it's complicated and I can't address it as well as I feel I should for my kid in my own time. You know, I think that is a great way that you put it, to just help parents know that is normal and part of your job as a parent to accept you can't solve all these problems on your own and find a way to get professional help.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things you talk about too is the idea that kids are not spending that much time in school. And I did the math on this before I found your book. And so I was just looking at like the regular school year and I think it was like 25% of awake hours. But then the way you did the math, it was like birth. And so you're like pre-K. And so it was only like 10% of the time that they were spending in the classroom. And so when you think about that, I mean, that's a big deal. So talk more about that.
Yeah. When I saw your podcast, when you reached out to me and I saw your website, I told my wife, oh my gosh, this woman thinks about things just like I think about things, because you had similar kinds of calculations in the back of your mind. I think the public K-12 education system, we take for granted in some ways, as this is what we provide for children as opportunity in America. But if you step back, it doesn't start until age 5. There's really nothing for families provided by the public before age 5. Yes, there's Head Start, you know, but Head Start is very underfunded. And there are a lot of hoops you have to jump through to get access to Head Start. So only a very small share of kids are eligible for Head Start, and a small share of eligible kids participate because it's just such a headache and so hard to get into. And then early Head Start, which is for ages 0 to 3, basically nobody participates in that. It's like a gesture rather than a full program.
Oh, it just doesn't exist? Like, why does no one, like, they don't have any seats?
It's radically underfunded. I think 5% of eligible kids participate in early Head Start or something like that.
Wow.
It's like a symbol almost. So before age 5, there's nothing. Then you get to public school and it's only in session about half of all days each year, because there's summer break and winter break and spring break and weekends. So 1 out of 2 days from age 5 to 18, your kids are not in school. They're your responsibility. And then on those 1 and 2 days when school is in session, it's in session for about a third of the day. So, you know, we take all this for granted that school ends at 2 or 3 and that there are these long extended vacations. And I'm not saying kids should be in an institutional setting, you know, every waking hour of their life. That would be terrible too. But I'm saying, pointing out that school only helps parents manage 10% of kids' time is a way to say maybe we could be providing other support during the 90% of the other time. Not necessarily butts in seats at public schools, but good early childhood education, good after school extracurricular programs, good summer programs. You know, there's a lot of options here.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree, because it's like when you do the math and you see how little they're actually in school.
Yeah.
Then it's like, okay, we can't just blame the schools.
No, right.
You know, and I mean, I know that I hear horror stories like in this work of schools that are legitimately bad schools. And so Sure. Those do exist. But for your average school, it's like, well, maybe they're, you know, not doing that different than other campuses, right? But then there's all these other things happening outside of school that are really making a difference for kids. And I mean, talking again as a people who are kind of first generation, solidly middle class, it's like you don't really realize, because, you know, to be able to jump, you may have had to, I can speak for myself, it was like, I didn't have tutors, I didn't have, you know, I was a latchkey kid, I came home and let myself in and watched music videos. And so, you know, you're like, well, I was able to succeed, but that's not the average kid. And so then when you start parenting, it takes a while to realize, like, oh, okay, there's all this extra stuff that my child, they may not just go to school and be able to absorb everything and move on. So how does this play out with the skill building opportunity gaps as you have this set of parents who are able to fund amazing summer camps and after school programs and enrichment, and then you have another set of parents that are just taking what the school offers and don't really have access to be able to do other things?
Yeah, it plays out in really vivid ways if you look at any measures of skill development over the course of childhood from age 0 to 18. By the time kids start kindergarten, the poor kids are massively behind the rich kids. And it's not just in cognitive test scores. You know, there's some controversy lately around cognitive test scores and what they capture. I think some of that is overblown and cognitive test scores have a lot of value. But if you prefer to look at social emotional skills as judged by teachers, lower income kids are also starting kindergarten way behind rich kids or upper middle class kids. And that's because age 0 to 5 is totally up to parents. It's totally on the shoulders of parents. I think if that were just more understood, that lower income kids reach kindergarten, which we consider sort of the front door of equal opportunity, way behind rich kids, it would be more scandalous. How can that be an American acceptable way to start school? You know, we just leave everything up to parents and then the poor kids show up way behind the rich kids. And it's crazy. So it shows up in that way, that early childhood is radically unequal. Early childhood is like 19th century, you know, and then school ends at 3 p.m. and there's summer break and winter break. And as you mentioned, the upper middle class kids are doing piano lessons. They're doing private soccer and basketball clubs with professional coaches that help them learn how to practice and get better and have a good attitude about, you know, struggling with loss and being worse than some kids and better than some kids, and tutors, you know, like kids from all social classes fall behind in certain subjects at certain points in time. And if you're an upper middle class parent, you can either help your kid directly, leveraging your own college education and your own professional skills, or you can procure help from a tutor. So all these things lead the poor kids to not only start way behind, but also gradually fall a little more behind over the course of K-12, even though their time in school is quite surprisingly equal. When they're in school, they're getting college-educated teachers. They're getting very similar class sizes. But all the stuff that happens around the edges of school is pulling them further and further behind. And then when they get to the end of K-12 and they have to think about college or early career options, they don't get the kinds of nitty-gritty support to handle that transition. So if you take a poor kid and a rich kid who have similar test scores and similar grades at the end of high school, the rich kid is still going to wind up going to a better college because they're having their hand held through all the paperwork and all the deadlines and all the emotional strife of like writing these tortured, you know, college essays about exactly how to frame your experience with adversity in a way that is not quite bragging, but not quite underselling yourself. There's just so much handholding that upper middle class and rich kids get in that transition to college or early career as well. So that's how all of these unequal opportunities really take shape and set up rich kids for much more lucrative and much more fulfilling careers over the course of their whole life than lower income kids on average.
Yeah, that really resonates. I lead the Texas College Access Network as my day job. And so that's like my entire work is around advising and like how to make sure students make that transition successfully.
Well, thanks for not interrupting me and telling me what I'm getting right and wrong and adding more detail because you know a lot more about that part of the problem than I do.
No, it was very validating reading your book. And I think that's why I've become so fascinated on the front end because, you know, we look at it at the end of kind of that whole trajectory and we're like, well, why aren't they choosing college? And then you're like, oh, they're struggling in math in kindergarten and they're not getting any support. And then you're just going through like a series of unsupported failures for 12 years. And then we show up and we're like, hey, how about 4 more years? It's probably not like the best at that point. So I've been really fascinated with like, how do we do more on the front end, even though it's not my day job?
Yeah. I love that point. I think the fact that if you're kind of behind school, it becomes less fun, you know, is a really important phenomenon. If school is a constant place to feel like you are not as good as you should be, and you're not able to keep up with what is considered normal and you don't get the support to overcome those challenges. Yeah. School is just a place to feel bad. It's not a place to build skills or further your own goals.
Yeah. And I don't think I really saw that until my son started struggling with math and it was like, oh, okay, let's do something about it. Wow. And so, I mean, we're growing, but it's still a challenge. Like every day to go in and he's like, well, how'd I do? You know, I can tell what he has in his backpack by his mood when he walks through the door. Like he's grumpy. It's not good. There's probably a redo in there. And so he really internalizes it. And so it's given me so much empathy for these babies that we have in this really high pressure situation, you know, and it's so early. It's so early for them to be making these, to be kind of giving up on math. Like, we're not going to give up at 8. Like, I understand everybody's not going to be a mathematician.
Yeah.
I resist it, but I accept it still.
Yeah.
But I think 8 is a little early on that trajectory.
Yeah. I have to ask, what interventions did you land on with your son? Are you getting some tutoring?
Yeah, so we started with Kumon. Are you familiar with that one?
Very much so.
Yes. Yeah, that was like pure math facts. Mm-hmm. And so then we've layered on Khan Academy. Mm-hmm. Because that is more like what he's doing in class. And it's interesting because he needs to see the relevance. Like with the Kumon, he doesn't really see the relevance. I see the relevance because I'm like, you're going to get fast and you're going to be able to do this stuff. But he wants help with what's happening tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so the Kumon's expensive. The Khan Academy is free, but it's time intensive. And so it's like.
For you.
For me. Yeah.
Totally.
And just emotionally exhausting because it's like you're trying to get him to do stuff. Why do I have to do extra stuff? And it's like, well, this is going to make life better for you.
Yeah. You know, can I mention one thing? I wrote a post in my newsletter on tutoring and how parents can try to tutor themselves sometimes, which is exhausting. And it might be, have you tried talking to ChatGPT with your son about why his Kumon homework is useful?
I have not. That's interesting.
That can be really fun. You can have a whole conversation with ChatGPT where you say, like, what math is your son learning at Kumon?
He is in third grade. And so it's like a mix of everything right now. It's like geometry and
pick a problem, pick a homework problem that he's struggling with, you know, and that he finally gets after six or seven practice problems with Kumon, and then put that problem into ChatGPT and say, why is it important to know this?
Oh, I love that.
And you can even make, you can just push until your son is like satisfied. Welcome his skepticism, because it'll be like, well, it's useful for this or that, you know, you need it for calculus or you need it for blah, blah, blah. And say, well, why is that important? And you can just keep pushing and say, give me a specific example. You know, you can be very demanding and skeptical, and it sometimes yields really fun answers.
I will try that with him, because he does want to see linkages. And so the way that the curriculum is now, we won't get all into that, but they like push everything down. And so one of the things he's working on is like dot plots. And so he's in Khan Academy. I get them mixed up because they're so similar names.
Yeah.
But he's in Khan Academy, and he was like, I want to see middle school math. And then he goes in there and he happens to click on the one where they're working on dot plots.
Okay.
And he's like able to do it because he's been doing dot plots for third grade math. And he was very energized by that. So I think that would be helpful for him to see, like, where is this going? Because he's naturally very skeptical.
Yeah. Which is a great quality, and it would be really nice to, I feel like a lot of kids are very skeptical, and that is a really constructive quality if it can be harnessed and addressed rather than viewed as like an obstruction.
Right. And his creativity is great in the real world, not so great in school. So that's a whole other podcast. But you did mention a little bit about test scores and how they're kind of falling out of favor. I get why now as a parent, because they have them taking like eight different tests and nobody knows what any of them mean. Mm-hmm. So I get that point.
Yeah.
But I still see value in just, you know, a few touch points to be able to see where our kids are. And recently I was looking at SAT data and average scores by different groups and percentage of kids over the criterion scores. And it was, some of the stuff was just very dark of like kids not being able to get over 1,000 on the SAT, which I feel like if you're getting a quality education, you should be able to, and I'm not qualified to make that statement, but just instinctually, it feels right.
Yeah.
I guess my question is more around, there are people questioning test scores and college at all. Like, does college even matter? Do we need to go? Can you talk about how those skill gaps impact a student's life outcomes? You have some really good stats in the book about earnings and just life outcomes.
Yeah. The skill gaps between rich kids and poor kids and disadvantaged minorities and white kids are very large, measured by these tests. And the income gaps, when these kids grow up from these different groups, the income gaps are very large. And those two facts are pretty related. In the book, I talk about, if you take a rich kid and a poor kid and you look at the subset of rich kids and poor kids who have similar test scores, 70% of the future income gap goes away. Most of that rich-poor income gap can be accounted for easily by a single cognitive test score.
I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I wonder about like other factors buried in there, because like what has to happen for that student to have similar test scores?
That's a valid concern, but it sure is an interesting starting point to just think about what might be going on. I mean, these test scores are, they're a measure of opportunity. These test scores are a measure of how much opportunity kids have had. And there are some lower income families who manage to get their kids a lot of opportunity. And there are some higher income families who are not able to get their kids as much opportunity. And, you know, for all kinds of complicated reasons, when you do find lower income and higher income kids who have similar test scores, most of their future income gap goes away.
Would you feel confident saying, parents, you should shoot for these high test scores? If I'm as a parent, I guess I'm like, if I'm able to get my kid these scores, does it mean that they're more likely to have a good life?
I think you have to be, you can't be too literal about it. You know, there's a lot of rich childhood opportunity that is driving this test score gap between rich kids and poor kids. And if you just, you know, drive your kid toward mastering a single test score, you're not going to get the full breadth of that rich opportunity. You're going to be kind of taking that gap too literally. But I do think it's still a really useful tool for parents to use and understand. You know, it's kind of a reality check built into the system, which we should welcome. And of course, it's not perfect. You know, some kids who have severe test anxiety, you have to work on that. And if you can't overcome that, then yeah, their test score is not going to be as useful a measure of how well they're doing. It's just going to be a measure of how nervous they were on test day. But by and large, If your kid has a test score that is way below state standards or way below other kids at your school, I do think parents should use that as a helpful signal that their kid could use some additional support in a very kind, nurturing way to improve on their math or their reading or both. And it shouldn't be dismissed defensively as, oh, my kid is different, or, oh, these test scores are so shallow. I don't think that serves kids all that well. I will also add, in addition to just these correlational kind of rough findings I'm talking about, that poor kids and rich kids with the same test score wind up getting pretty similar earnings later in life, there's a whole group of other studies showing that when you do have big interventions in the lives of kids, and these interventions are studied rigorously with randomized controlled trials and good natural experiments, a lot of these big interventions, they both increase kids' test scores and they increase their later life outcomes. And that, to me, is very reassuring that there is something causal at work, that part of the reason why poor kids grow up to earn less income than rich kids is because they're not building the skills that are partly captured by these tests.
Let's talk about homework. So as I talk to parents, so many call out homework as a challenge. Some feel like their kids are getting too much. Others, they're like, my kid doesn't get any homework. Like, is this normal? It really varies, as well as how effective parents feel like it is. I was recapping on your book today, and I saw this part where you said there was a study that found that good tutoring improved children's outcomes even more than good teaching, which I thought was really interesting. And you said good tutoring by parents for 6 hours a week. That's a lot of hours. But you said 6 hours a week, year after year, could raise a child's future earnings by as much as $300,000, which is a lot.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it. What are your thoughts on homework? What are you hearing?
I have mixed feelings about homework because it is putting a big burden on parents implicitly to be teachers. And some parents are going to, you know, execute that assignment very successfully and easily, and other parents are not going to execute that assignment very easily. So I feel it contributes to inequality, but I also feel homework is a valuable extension of a teacher's professional knowledge. You know, it gives kids a structured set of things to practice that are happening at the right time with their peers, and it can have value. I don't feel like I have a great opinion on the exact right amount of homework. I think it is a hard question how to balance the stress involved in filling up a kid's nights with homework versus the value that comes from extending what is basically a pretty short school day and giving some structure to help kids build skills when they're not in school. I think there's some potential large value in that.
My vote would be for optional homework, because I feel like it doesn't necessarily reduce the inequality, because the parents who don't get any homework, they're finding homework. I have one friend and she's like, I looked at the learning standards and I mapped it all out. I have workbooks. And so she just created her own homework. And then there's parents putting their kids into programs. So I feel like by not assigning anything or giving it even as an option, then the parents who know how to get to it or can afford it, they're getting it anyway still. It's just harder for them.
That's a great point.
But then the ones that can't afford it, they're like, oh, yeah, it's no homework. Life is good. Everything's good.
Making it optional, I just feel like I worry that not only doesn't solve the inequality problem, but it exacerbates it. You know,
the ones that take the option are going to.
Yeah, the kids who need to do the homework the most are going to be the least likely to do the homework for sure. Mm-hmm. I feel like making it required at least sets the norm that all kids are expected to do it. And I just feel like the school needs to. The ideal solution that I advocate for in the book is that, you know, schools should provide additional tutoring and support so that when homework is assigned, the kids who need help doing it get it. And it's not just the kids who are lucky to have highly involved parents getting that support.
I do love that. Like Sean has tutoring at school, and on the days where he just does any redos at school, it's the best. Those are the best days.
That's perfect. That's amazing. That's an amazing thing to hear. Yeah. I feel like that there's a lot of talk about scaling up tutoring in the public schools. And I feel that is a very promising idea.
Yeah. Because we don't know how to do it. We're trying to figure it out. Like, we can get someone who knows.
Definitely. I mean, rich parents, they're effectively doing that privately. They're borrowing from their own skills and their own, you know, human capital to do this for free for their kids on behalf of the school, sort of. or they're paying somebody to do it. And it's just crazy.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about grades. I did another episode where I talked with a parent advocate, and she actually did an experiment similar to the one that you cited in the group, where she brought in parents, asked them how they thought their kids were doing in reading. They all were like, oh, my kid's doing great. They're on grade level. Everything's great. And then they gave them the assessment and they realized like, oh, actually, you know, a lot of them, their kids were behind. Or what are the challenges around making sure parents understand where their students are and like how they might need to lean in or get support?
Yeah. This is partly what standardized test scores are good for, is if you're a parent attended in a lower income community, a working class community, there is a much larger chance that a typical kid at your children's school is below grade level. And that's frustrating for teachers and principals at the school. They don't want to feel like they're failing at their jobs, nor should they, because these kids have not gotten as much support in early education and after school and summers. And the test scores in these schools can help clue parents in to what is normal nationally rather than what is normal locally. These test score reports are often very hard to read. You get a sheet of paper that has a lot of numbers and jargon and diagrams, and parents often lean on teachers to tell them if the test score reports signal anything that they should be worried about. I, as you mentioned in the book, I talk about how that leads to a lot of misunderstanding in exactly the kinds of ways you're talking about. The parents think everything is fine because teachers feel, well, this is normal for our community. And so it doesn't seem like a problem to me because I don't want to feel like I'm failing, because you're not failing. But if parents learn that many kids in their working class or lower income community were below grade level, and this was a problem for the whole community, it would change the discourse in those communities. And I think test scores can play a really promising role in those ways. Unfortunately, there's not a quick fix. It's not like these parents are being denied a quick fix and they can just seize that. What they're being denied is opportunity for the first 5 freaking years of their child's lives. And they're being denied opportunity every year, all summer long, and every day after school. So the response, I guess, is if parents can get this information and do something with it on their own, that's really productive. You know, if they can find ways to get subsidized tutoring or subsidized small group support, then that's really productive. But yes, relying on grades alone can be very dangerous.
Yeah. Understanding the test scores is just a whole thing. Like, I talk about my son a lot on this podcast, but when he started taking the MAP test for the reading, his scores were not where I thought they would be, because he was one of those kids like reading before kindergarten, loved books. You didn't find him without a book in his hand. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I start learning about the test. And it's like, it's testing comprehension. It's testing like all these other things.
Yeah.
To your point about, you kind of need to be a reading instructor to be able to fully support your kid.
Yeah.
I think we get all this messaging. They're like, oh, you just read to your kid every night and, you know, make sure they can read and you're doing good. And so when you see the test scores and you're like, well, this doesn't match what I'm seeing, but then you don't understand why, and there's no like roadmap of how to improve that.
Yeah.
It's really challenging.
That does sound very challenging. Yeah.
Yeah. It's coming for you.
It is. I know. I'm sort of dreading it, but looking forward to it.
You'll be good. You'll be good. You have all this knowledge. We're figuring it out. And then you have 2 kids too. I have 2 kids. So it's like the second one, like we already know.
But you're a pro. Yeah.
So I really appreciate it. You had an entire chapter of your book that you dedicated to the cross-section of skill development and racial equality. And you just really beautifully told the story of what happened, because I feel like that's often the question people have, and really acknowledging like those early years and like how badly Black people immediately after the end of slavery wanted to learn, and during slavery and all the efforts that they put into it, and how they were just squashed at every turn. So can you talk a little bit about this and the history that led to the inequitable outcomes that we see today?
I think the part of the story that you mentioned is really underappreciated. The massive, overwhelming appetite of the Black community to build skills at every chance they had during slavery, with all kinds of secret, illicit learning groups, which are, to me, just feel like great Hollywood material, you know? Like a sort of a dark comedy, people trying to basically cram and learn and better themselves. And it was a crime, and with really high stakes. And so there were all these tricks and and plot devious plots to like learn how to read and write. And I found that really dramatic and fun to read about. And then after slavery, yeah, the Black community just was dying to stop getting cheated in contract negotiations. They just really seemed to be completely aware that this was a path to improving their economic prospects. There was a big movement to keep Black people in segregated, massively lower quality schools. You know, people know that Black people attended segregated schools. I don't think it's as commonly understood just how much lower quality these schools were. You know, their class sizes were enormous and their teachers didn't have any training in many cases. And this whole phenomenon of making it 10 times harder for Black kids to develop skills over the course of their childhood as white kids led generation after generation to Black kids reaching adulthood with weaker skills, reading, writing, math. They just didn't get the chance to develop these skills. And because school is only a small part of childhood and the rest of childhood is placed on the shoulders of parents to help kids build skills, that kind of massively reinforced and entrenched this skill development disadvantage of the Black community. Because not only were they for many generations forced to attend massively lower quality schools that led their parents generationally to struggle more to impart skills to kids in that large share of childhood that is spent outside of school. And I think this is really the biggest reason why even after much greater equality in schools, the end of segregated schooling, the advent of the civil rights movement that knocked down a lot of nominal barriers to accessing different occupations, I think the biggest reason why that hasn't played out as wonderfully in economic terms for the Black community is because of these very deep multi-generational disadvantages in skill development.
Yeah. And I thought it was really artfully placed in the book, the way where you introduce this conversation, because you talked about trying to write it in a way that didn't blame the parents. And I think for like the Black population, there's often this narrative of, well, they just don't value education as much. Like they're just not, you know, committed to it or understanding it. But then when you really see, even if it produces an apathy, like even if that's where you end up after you've been told generation after generation, no, you are not allowed in here.
Yeah.
It's a really hard thing to just roll back without a lot of intentionality.
Yeah, it's a really justifiably sensitive topic. You know, sometimes I think there's too much sensitivity placed on racial dialogue today, where it's just like kind of preventing people from even discussing the topic because they feel they're going to be screamed at. But there are real reasons why the conversation around skill inequality across racial groups is like very sensitive and can be counterproductive.
Yeah. I appreciate you for being brave and getting out to that conversation.
Fortunately, I'm not important enough to be a target of like the mob. You know, nobody cares that much what I say. So the stakes are not that high.
No, I think it's important. And even thinking about our kids and educating them, that's something that recently I had a conversation with my son and was just telling him about the legacy of this is where your grandparents came from. And, you know, this is how this generation did better. And this is what I did. And this is what I'm trying to set up for you. And he was really interested. And so I think a lot of times we try to run from the history. I can speak for myself. It's like, I don't want to make my son feel, you know, inferior. And, you know, he's getting all these messages in school where they're teaching basically slavery and civil rights. And it's like, there's so much more.
Yeah.
But I think understanding that history is important as we're building our kids up. So this has been great. We have to end at some point. And so I have one more question for you. Knowing that we can't solve all the problems that exist, what are three things that you believe every parent should do to help their child build skills at home?
Okay. I thought about this, Sharia, and I'm going to cheat a little bit.
That's fine.
Yeah. I think if people have been listening to this conversation, they know that we're really focused on the whole of childhood and getting people to stop thinking about just K-12 education. And there are really four parts of childhood where I think parents can, if they're aware that the stakes are high and that they do have a lot of power to benefit their kid long-term, they can potentially take action. The four areas are early education, you know, before age five. Then there's being an advocate during K-12. There's taking care of extracurricular and summer activities. And then there's the transition to college and early career formation. And in each of those areas, I think parents who are really motivated and aware that what they do can make a difference, can have a big impact. And I want to tread carefully because a lot of the best solutions here are very expensive and very time consuming. And there are, it's not like parents cannot do everything to just give their kids what upper middle class kids are privately supplying to their children. But in early education, I do think reading to your kid and using the public library to fill your home with books. I think some parents feel like it's rude to maximize the number of books they take out from the library. Talk to your library, say, how many books can I take out? If they say 50.
It's like 30 books.
30, 50, take out 30, 50 books. You know, don't think it's rude and think, oh, I'm hogging all the books. No, that's what the library is for. Use them, have your home full of books, make books a fun, abundant, easy thing for your kid to access and enjoy with you. Talking to your kid, Dana Suskin emphasizes the three T's, talk more, tune in, and take turns. And before age 5, that's not always obvious to parents, but really leaning into language and conversation with your kid, showing them that you care what they say, that you're listening to them, you're having a conversation with them, even babies. You can have a conversation with babies. You look into their eyes and you respond to their noises. And that starts to teach the baby that when they make sound, the world responds. And it doesn't happen from TV. TV does not teach babies language. And just knowing that can be helpful to parents. So reading and talking actively with your kid in early childhood is a big thing. The harder thing is finding a good solution for childcare. And whatever you choose, you can't necessarily spend $10,000, $20,000 a year to find what you really want. But whatever you choose, try to find something that also is reading and talking and conversing with your kid at that age. And if the class is so big that the teachers are never talking to your kid, see if you can find a better option. Sometimes you can't, and you got to show yourself grace because our society is not making this possible for everybody right now. So that's the first thing. The second thing is in school, being an advocate and being proactive and knowing that the school is not doing that for your kid necessarily. You have really told some great stories about how you've played that role for your kid and how it's challenging, but talk to your teacher, ask for that test score. How does this test score compare to my state expectation? The state of Utah, the state of California, the state of New Hampshire, how does my kid compare to the state expectation? Not this school, but the state. And make sure that your kid is doing better than what is expected. And if not, ask for what resources and supports are available to you. What are you entitled to? What nonprofit, church, or library resources can your school help you become aware of that you can use to help your kid? After school, summer, extracurricular activities, again, knowing that this is valuable and important can help parents try to take action. Again, the best solutions are often out of reach. They're too expensive right now, but there are churches and libraries and public school and local city options that are often heavily subsidized. And join a Facebook local parenting group and ask people and don't feel like you're being too aggressive. You know, you are your child's only real advocate. There is nobody else who is doing that. And so when you feel that squeamishness and you feel that insecurity that maybe you're being obnoxious, maybe you're being neurotic or asking too many questions, remember that you are your child's only advocate. So it's sort of like, if you were in court, would you want your defense attorney to be shy? You wouldn't. You would want them to err on the side of getting what you are entitled to. And that's kind of the role that you need to see yourself playing for your child. And then lastly, I know this is where I'm cheating. I've given you three areas where I feel like parents can step up if they have time and energy and, you know, awareness that this stuff matters. The fourth area is the transition to college and early career formation. This is a really sensitive area. Some parents mistakenly, I believe, view this as a place for kids to take personal responsibility for their own future. I feel like kids have many chances to practice personal responsibility. And this transition from high school to college or early career formation is not a great place to practice personal responsibility. You can kind of point your kid in that direction, and if they are showing a great deal of personal responsibility, run with it. But if they're not, you jump in there and you hold their freaking hand and you get them into the best public 2-year or 4-year college that you possibly can. You get every ounce of financial aid that you possibly can, and you get a good apprenticeship if they don't want to go to college. You make sure they're working with an electrician or a plumber, you know, an IT specialist who is going to mentor them. And you view this as again, you are the parent and you are the advocate, and this little 18-year-old is not thinking clearly about the consequences of their actions at this critical juncture of their life. And by the way, your high school guidance counselor, if you're in a public school, probably has 400 or 500 other kids that they have to advocate for. So again, don't assume anybody else has your kids back at this critical juncture, and try to talk to that uncle who has a college degree. Talk to that cousin who just applied to 12 colleges. Use any scrap of your social network to get a little more edge on your kid attending the best next step in their life after high school, because that's a big place where balls get dropped in our system.
I love that. Well, thanks so much for being here today. If people want to get in touch with you, of course, they can read your book, The Parent Trap, but where else can they find you?
I have a newsletter on Substack called Kidding Around, and it kind of continues the conversation in the book and tries to be kind of snackable content, you know, fun stuff for people to read on it who don't have time to read a whole book necessarily. So you can find me at Kidding Around, and you can just go to my website, natehilger.com, and reach out to me. And I'd love to hear from you.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Sharia. It was a real pleasure. Thanks for your really thoughtful question.
Well, there you have it, friends. I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. And I hope that as you reflect on this conversation, you think about that thing that has been holding you down, stressing you out about being a parent, and try to think of someone you could engage for help. Maybe it's someone at your kid's school. Maybe it's someone you could hire. Maybe it's a friend who could be going through similar things, but you just don't know it until you ask them. As parents, it's important for us to be scrappy and strategic and try to figure out how to get our kids the help that they need. And so I really encourage you to do that. If you know anybody who's been struggling to do all the things for their kids and you think they would like this episode, it would mean the world to me if you would share it. Wherever you're listening, there should be a share button where you can just copy the link and text it right over to them. All right, I hope to see you again really soon.